Please be seated. Good afternoon. We have our third case for today, 02-0386-D, Office of Lawyer Regulation v. Alan D. Eisenberg. Representing Mr. Eisenberg is Richard J. Kale. Mr. Kale.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the Court, my name is Richard Kale, the law firm of Howling & Kale. I appear here on behalf of the appellant respondent, Alan D. Eisenberg, in this lawyer disciplinary case. I'm proud to be here on behalf of Mr. Eisenberg, and not just because of the impressive record of community service by Mr. Eisenberg as reflected in our brief, but because as a lawyer, Mr. Eisenberg is a valuable, indispensable, irreplaceable asset to the community and the constituency which he serves. I have little doubt over the course of his career, Mr. Eisenberg has been the bane of many a lawyer with whom he's battled, and that in the course of his career, he's rankled a judge or two. But for every rankled lawyer, there are dozens of clients who regard this man as a savior, particularly clients who are underdogs. If you're a person from any walk of life in trouble, against whom powerful forces of the government are arrayed, Alan Eisenberg is a tireless, fearless worker who will be a good ally for you. We need look little further than the facts of this case to see examples of it. If you're Pearl P. Piora, one of the complainants in this case, fighting the City of Milwaukee Housing Authority with a $200 budget, Alan Eisenberg will speak for you. As few other lawyers in this state will. If you're Quinn Munson, another of the persons whose case forms the basis for some of these charges, fighting with the Department of Transportation, being ground up, perhaps on account of your age or your race, Alan Eisenberg is a powerful ally. If you're Jeff Edwards, fighting for your life in Corvallis, Oregon, Alan Eisenberg has the skill to try a 5-day jury trial for you and get an acquittal. This is not easy work. It's not work for the faint-hearted, for the timid, for the obsequious, or the bashful, shortcomings of which Mr. Eisenberg has never been accused. It is indeed a hardball game, as I myself was once told. And Mr. Eisenberg has undertaken this game with a good deal of success and a lot of passion. And if passion is a necessary ingredient to the success he's had, it also, on occasion, spills over into unfortunate consequences, such as some of those matters that form the basis for the charges that you're considering. Mr. Eisenberg has admitted mistakes in these matters. He has apologized in these matters. But if passion's on occasion a vice, nowhere is it more evident in this case than in the report of the referee from which this appeal is taken. One need know little about the facts of this case to come to that conclusion. A reading of the report itself reflects that it is more the product of anger, perhaps of a personality clash, than it is of reason.
Mr. Kale, don't you think that the referee had some valid points when he was pointing out that Mr. Eisenberg is an attorney who's been disciplined several times previously, in each instance for activity that was somewhat akin to what's been alleged and now found by the referee in this case? So do you think you can just dismiss the recommendation of the referee here?
Two parts to your question. The referee cited his prior disciplinary history, and it is correct. He has been the subject of discipline on three separate occasions. But if there's a pattern to be divined from that prior misconduct, it certainly isn't a very dense weave, because the first of the matters for which he was disciplined was in 1970, some 34 years ago. The second was in 1988, which is 16 years ago. And the most recent was a public reprimand for a minor matter in 1996. So notwithstanding that there's been some prior discipline, I don't think it's fair to say it represents a pattern that bears significantly on this decision. And the second part of your question was, does the referee have any valid points? And I think the answer is yes. There are some matters in this record for which Mr. Eisenberg is a legitimate recipient of criticism and for which he has already apologized.
What are those?
Mr. Eisenberg has admitted that he was overbearing in his dealings with hearing examiner Shaw. He's apologized on countless occasions, and I take this opportunity on his behalf to do so again today. I think that he certainly should have been more careful in reviewing the Pro Hoc Vitae application that was prepared for him by a California counsel, which contained a misstatement of fact in which he signed and faxed back to his California colleague. But in that instance, that's certainly a far cry from making a deliberate misrepresentation to a court. He could have been more prompt in returning to Attorney Murphy the file that she had requested, although he certainly did so promptly after receiving the substitution, the stipulation in order for substitution that he requested. He certainly doesn't endorse the use of the words that he used in speaking with the Corvallis police dispatcher. But I submit to you that any defense attorney worth his salt under those circumstances would, as Mr. Eisenberg was, be livid about the conduct of the authorities in relation to his client, Jeff Edwards, in Corvallis, Oregon.
When we go to the valid points of the referee, what about the referee's points to the effect that Mr. Eisenberg was not honest in his testimony in front of the referee? Isn't that significant given the three prior disciplinary actions by this court?
I would submit to you that this record contains not one single shred of evidence supporting the referee's contention that Mr. Eisenberg was dishonest. Nor does the referee point out to any particular instance where he claims so. One instance that he claims dishonesty is in connection with Mr. Eisenberg's contention that he personally evaluated a restaurant in connection with the Swisiak divorce case. And the referee was prepared to declare that Mr. Eisenberg was dishonest in that testimony without a single shred of basis for doing so.
Well, he just didn't believe him.
No, he didn't. And it's fair to say that this report is so oozing and seething with anger that he didn't like Mr. Eisenberg and was, but.
Where does that show up? I mean, he says he doesn't believe him, but, you know, doesn't mean you're angry at him.
I think that report.
I mean, because what you're really saying is you had a biased referee. I mean, that's what you're saying.
I don't want to castigate the referee because I'm sure he's a good person and a strong jurist, and sometimes I think strong personalities collide and objectivity is the casualty. And I believe that's what happened here. I think he didn't like Mr. Eisenberg and he was not prepared to believe anything he said.
Well, that's a biased fact finder because there's a personal agenda, a personal concept that overrides the neutrality and objectivity of somebody. I mean, that's what you're saying.
Yes.
And I'm saying, that's what I hear, that's what I read. And that's really what you're relying on. You may call it that he didn't like it, but it boils down to his personal antagonism overrode his neutrality as a magistrate.
Yes, Chief Justice. And I'm not guessing at that. This report contains findings with respect to which there is no evidence. It contains findings
You have to give me examples.
Two most glaring examples are two of the most serious counts. The Pro Hoc Vitae count is an alleged violation of SCR 20:3.3 sub A that he knowingly made a misstatement of fact to a judge. I would submit, and in fact, this verified petition for admission Pro Hoc Vitae to the State of California indeed contained a mistake. It said, I've never previously been the subject of discipline, and we all know it's a matter of public record that he has previously been the subject of discipline. Mr. Eisenberg contended and testified that was a mistake, and every piece of evidence in this record supports that contention.
He said it was a mistake. He said it was brought in by somebody who obviously didn't read it carefully. He didn't read it carefully. He was in a hurry. He signed it. This was an honest mistake.
Correct.
The referee, if I remember this correctly, said, he's had other Pro Hoc Vitae examples. He knows that one of the things asked in a Pro Hoc Vitae statement is, have you been disciplined or are you under discipline now, right?
No, okay. Justice. To the contrary, Mr. Eisenberg has been admitted Pro Hoc Vitae in the State of California previously, and California Rule of Court 983 does not require an averment that you've been without prior discipline elsewhere, only that you're in good standing in the jurisdiction from which you're coming.
Okay.
So he knew that I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
He knew that he didn't have to make that statement in order to be admitted. And this contention that this was signed hastily, which is not a request that he be absolved entirely of making a mistake, but is certainly corroborative of his claim that it was indeed just a mistake, is absolutely categorically proven by the fax transmission data, which is in evidence in this case, showing that this pro hoc vice application was prepared by attorney Michael Odenino, faxed to Mr. Eisenberg, picked up off the fax machine by his assistant Lisa Coons, delivered to him in the midst of a conference with another client, reviewed hastily, regarded as a rather routine matter by Mr. Eisenberg, signed and faxed back to California all within 3 minutes. Mr. Eisenberg's conduct after this mistake was called to his attention further corroborates the fact that it was a mistake. He was told, look, this contains a misstatement. It contains a claim that you weren't previously the subject of discipline. And Mr. Eisenberg said, that was a mistake. Undo that. And Attorney Odenino made known to everybody that that wasn't true. I submit to you, lawyers make mistakes, make misrepresentations of facts to judges in courtrooms all across this state every single day. I dare say they make misstatements of fact to this court virtually on a daily basis, and they're not subject to discipline in matters of greater importance than this. This, I think, was an opportunity to prosecute Alan Eisenberg, not something that required the prosecution, and least of all is that charge established by clear and satisfactory evidence. This referee said the evidence shows Mr. Eisenberg knowingly and deliberately lied to that court. He had no reason to do that, and Attorney Odenino testified, and he was a credible witness, that he prepared this petition for pro hoc vice admission based on a form he'd used in another case, that the language was superfluous, that he was, quote, gilding the lily, and that none of the information in the form except Mr. Eisenberg's name was obtained from Mr. Eisenberg or anyone on his behalf.
Counsel, what do we do with the findings of fact on that particular issue?
This court has original jurisdiction. The clearly erroneous standard applies to findings of fact, as I understand it, under the Kalal case. And I think that with respect to that finding of fact and others, that this court has to overturn and declare that this record contains no evidence sufficient to support that, least of all clear and convincing evidence.
I'm bothered by the standard of review, which is just exactly what you said. It's an erroneous exercise of discretion. It seems to me that a lot of what is said here, not necessarily all, is a matter of credibility. And credibility determinations we usually do leave to the trier of fact. And as an appellate court, we don't touch them. And so the finding of dishonesty, deceit, not credible at all, permeates this report that I'm referring to. So just from an appellate review, don't we say, look, the finder of fact is the final arbiter with regard to issues of credibility. He determined that your client is unbelievable. And under the erroneous exercise of discretion standard, end of story. Tell me why I'm wrong.
Well, it is certainly, I believe, an abuse of that prerogative to make credibility judgments to say, I'm going to take everything you say. Your credibility is so low, I'm going to take things that you say as proof of the contrary proposition. That certainly isn't competent evidence. And with respect to the pro hoc vice count and the Pearl Piora conflict count that I'd like to talk about, one needn't even credit Mr. Eisenberg's testimony to recognize that those counts are without any evidence. For example, we know that there's a misstatement of fact in this pro hoc vice application. It's superfluous. It's unnecessary to secure the purposes of moving pro hoc vice. We know that the document was prepared by other counsel, and we know from the testimony of other people, Lisa Coons, who the referee said was credible, that Mr. Eisenberg reviewed it hastily in the midst of another conference. We know from the fax transmission data that it was in his office only 3 minutes. Why would anyone infer, when he has no motive to lie to that court, that that was anything other than a mistake?
Go ahead.
With respect to the Pearl P. Piora case, another serious count, he's
okay.
Accused of...
Just wait a minute.
Yes.
I want to ask you, you mentioned about his procedure before the Department of Transportation. I just was reviewing the transcript, just the short part that's in your blue brief. It's pages 147 through 149. I was struck by this exchange. This is with Ms. Shaw, who is a hearing examiner for the department. And just going through this, it basically was whether Mr. Eisenberg was going to follow the procedures or not. And there's just one statement I wanted to call to your attention, 149. This is Mr. Eisenberg. He said, I am making a statement now, he told the hearing examiner. You will be silent while I make my statement for the record. I'm not interested in your procedures. I'm interested in due process and the law. I'm going to make a statement now. You will remain silent while I make the statement. Do we understand each other? Now, this is what do you think a hearing examiner is? Do you think that you made the argument that that wasn't the same as being before a judge?
We earlier in this case made the argument that that Supreme Court rule, according to special deference to judicial officers, did not apply to hearing examiners under these circumstances, and we've abandoned that argument.
Well, okay. But just the language for three pages, I'm not going to read the whole thing or take your time, but telling the hearing examiner, be silent, last chance. If you speak again while I make my statement, we'll proceed right into circuit court. I'm going to make a statement. And the whole exchange here, which is this is not a resurrection of your client's memory or the department examiner memory. This is the transcript. And when you read this, it seems to be over the top.
Correct, Justice Wilcox, and it is over the top. I have a couple things to say about it. Number one, without regard to whether she is entitled to the special deference accorded to judges or not, Mr. Eisenberg didn't think of her as a judge at the time. He thought of her as an agent of his client's opponent under the circumstances. I would submit to you, good lawyers fight with opposing parties, and good lawyers from time to time fight with judges. Now, there are bounds of advocacy, and we are prepared to acknowledge they were crossed in this case. But those are not lines that are easy to see. If I raise my voice in responding to your question, I might just be a persuasive speaker, and if I go a couple decibels higher, I might be answering to the bailiff.
I think, counsel, whether it's the entire exchange about who was running the hearing, and the examiner said, oh, certainly you can make a statement, but these are the procedures, and that totally was obliterated.
Yes. Justice Wilcox, Mr. Eisenberg has apologized for that conduct on repeated occasions, and does so today.
It seems to be a pattern of repeated occasions is what you take that. Is there a pattern here?
I don't think that's a fair statement.
That's what I want to know.
I don't think that's a fair statement. Mr. Eisenberg, there is conduct in Mr. Eisenberg's disciplinary past.
Don't forget the past. Just talk about these cases that are before us. Is there a pattern between these cases of language and how you handle people?
In connection with the Corvallis, Oregon matter, there's an allegation that Mr. Eisenberg engaged in offensive personality because he spoke using salty language to describe a police officer who was attempting to contact his client in the midst of a 5-day jury trial other than through him.
But he said a matter of life or death.
Yes, correct.
What was this trial about?
This trial was a sexual assault trial that had a for which this client could have been in prison, so far as I understand, for life.
All right.
And to tell the story in more detail, certain of the counts against this client, Jeff Edwards, were dismissed on Monday morning of the 5-day trial. A detective, John Kiefer, who had investigated those charges, was present in court to see his counts dismissed. In the midst of the trial, which was going well for the defense, Detective Kiefer appeared at the client's home, tried to reach him, left a card, and instructed Mr. Kiefer to call. Mr. Edwards. Mr. Edwards was distraught. He was hysterical. He went to Mr. Eisenberg at his hotel and told Mr. Eisenberg, this is a life and death emergency. and Mr. Eisenberg, having learned that the authorities were trying to contact his clients, was incensed and called and tried to reach Detective Kiefer to put an end to it. He himself used the words life and death emergencies, and that, to my way of thinking, it's justified by any one of a number of different rationales. Number one, it was a very serious matter. Number two, if I were to say this podium weighs a ton, am I to be disciplined because it's 1,000 pounds? It's a little hyperbole. It's an expression of speech meant to convey
puffery.
A little bit.
Didn't he threaten the officer? Didn't
he said, I'll have your badge.
Well, isn't that a threat?
Yes, it is. And in fact, that officer who lied about his explanation for why he was trying to contact Mr. Edwards and who was trying to circumvent Mr. Eisenberg's representation of Mr. Edwards should lose his badge. Any good defense lawyer would have been incensed. The obscenity in connection with that Corvallis incident was the behavior of that officer, not the word asshole that Mr. Eisenberg used in speaking about that officer to another dispatcher. And use of the word life and death emergency wasn't taken seriously by this dispatcher. They didn't take ambulances or fire trucks out of service to respond to Mr. Eisenberg. They put him on hold and laughed amongst themselves about who this person was who was calling and making...
Mr. Cale, how would you define the term offensive personality? What do you think that means?
Offensive personality was defined in the Heilprin case, which is cited by the referee and by the OLR, and indeed that was offensive personality. He was a sexual predator in relation to his clients. And to analogize that to the conduct in this case is ridiculous.
You know, all of us have the opportunity to administer the oath to new lawyers being admitted to practice in the state of Wisconsin. And when we talk about the oath, one of the things that's emphasized is offensive personality. Now, you don't see any pattern here in regard to the actions of Mr. Eisenberg on these charges or over his past disciplinary history relating to offensive personality?
I will acknowledge Mr. Eisenberg is a fierce fighter.
And from I didn't ask you about being a fierce fighter. You can be a fierce fighter without being a person who's involved with offensive personality.
Right.
You don't see a pattern?
I do not. My time is running short.
What does offensive personality mean? I read that oath all the time.
In my opinion...
A lot of people, a lot of lawyers, judges. What does it mean?
In my opinion, it has no place in our disciplinary law because it's constitutionally vague. I don't think it alerts lawyers to what they can or can't do. It's been involved in cases where a lawyer tried to run down someone in a campaign dispute. It's been used in instances where lawyers are sexually inappropriate with their clients. I don't think it's well defined. It's not part of the model rules. It's not part of our Supreme Court rules except by its inclusion in the attorney's oath. I think it's very difficult to define. This Court has done so on a few occasions. I want to make one other point with the limited time I have. I think there's no evidence to sustain the conflict of interest charge in the Pearl Pipiora case. And what's most glaringly intemperate about the referee's report is the disproportionate sanction, which is wholly inappropriate to the conduct in this case. You need know little more than that the OLR, the agency to which you've committed prosecution of these cases, investigated this matter with the use of professional staff. They referred it to a district committee. They studied it carefully. They assigned one of their most preeminent trial lawyers to plead and prove and conduct discovery in this case and try it over a many-day period of time, and recommended to this referee the imposition of a one-year suspension. This is an agency which took into account Mr. Eisenberg's disciplinary history and drew upon its vast familiarity with lawyer disciplinary cases throughout recent years and all across this state. And trying to achieve some measure of consistency is an important part of this process. This is not a revocation case, and we ask for your help.
You're careful in not telling us what you think would be a reasonable discipline in this case.
I would be happy to. If you eliminate, as I think you must, the Pearl PPR conflict of interest count, you eliminate the Pro Hoc Vice misrepresentation to a judge count, you eliminate what I would characterize as the totally unsupported claims of misrepresentation in connection with the Swisiak divorce case, where he submitted an affidavit to a judge and told the judge on the record this was prepared by other people. and is to be faulted now for not having said so in the body of the affidavit itself. If you eliminate the charges with respect to which there is no evidence whatsoever, this is a reprimand case. And if you look at the John Carroll case, which I submit to you is as close as we could come in finding parallel allegations, that's exactly what happened to Attorney Carroll. The 1 year recommended by the OLR to the referee was done very knowledgeably, and it was ambitious.
Any questions, Mr. Kao? Do you have anything further you want to add? At this time, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
My co-counsel, Mr. Eisenberg, is going to address you during the time available to us for rebuttal, and I thank you for your time.
Good counsel. Attorney Robert G. Crone of Edgerton, representing OLR. Mr. Crone.
Thank you. Members of the court, I include the court. And I have the pleasure of representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation in this disciplinary proceeding. You have before you a very comprehensive referee's report from Referee Volke. Central to all of his determinations in this case are his findings as to credibility. Credibility as to the events and the five charges, or five separate matters, as to what happened, and credibility as it relates to the respondent Eisenberg's explanation of those events and explanation for his conduct. The referee, as Justice Bradley has mentioned, is in the best position to assess credibility. And these are not my words, members of the court, but this referee, as you can well tell, or didn't mince his words when he said Mr. Eisenberg throughout this hearing was, quote, deliberately lying throughout his testimony, end of quote. Time and again, Mr. Eisenberg offered explanations of his conduct that did not ring true. His testimony was evasive, narrative, and non-responsive. This isn't a case not about likability, members of the court. This is a case where the referee legitimately found, as an objective fact finder, that Mr. Eisenberg, I'm getting up, standing too close. This is a case where Mr. Eisenberg was described by the referee as surly, angry, and explosive. Now, there are five separate matters. The Swieziak divorce matter.
Counsel, can I just ask about that, because opposing counsel indicated that we should disregard that completely when he made his recommendation for discipline. As I read this, and I'm reading on Appendix 116, where Judge Gooley in a transcript expresses disbelief that over $5,000 could be billed in a divorce before there was even a pretrial. Is that a misstatement, or is that actually what happened? In other words, I understand there was a splitting of fees and that Murphy had left. I understand the facts, but there was a retainer of $5,000, and then the balance, they were asking for the balance of the funds, which was over $2,000, and then it ended up where the $5,000 was expended, and then they wanted another $200 and some, and later on, I think, another $400.
But honestly, Justice Wilcox, the fee issue in the Swieziak divorce was not central to the evaluation or the prosecution, and there wasn't much testimony on it, and we didn't consider it a fee dispute.
Okay.
That case, in our view, turned
out. But it was a dispute over how they came to the.
That's correct.
Wasn't it? That's what I was just trying to get at what the argument was there.
The affidavit that was submitted to Judge Gooley was based upon information that was compiled by two of Mr. Eisenberg's employees. He signed that affidavit, although he made some qualification to the court. The representations in that affidavit were legitimately taken by the court to be true, and representations from him. In fact, it was information compiled by his employees, and the referee indicated that as to one of the employees, he thought that the compilations and information she provided were valueless. Neither of these two people had specific first-hand knowledge of what was done, and Mr. Eisenberg was attempting to craft an affidavit to include work that he contended he did on the Swieziak case, and also that he contended that his former associate, Lori Murphy, did but did not bill in the case. And in all instances, he relied upon documents that were kind of thrown together by his staff. Described the billing was described by referee Volkey as bogus. It simply didn't ring true. For instance, Ms. Murphy testified and was found, frankly, by the referee to be the most credible witness at this multi-day hearing. She said Mr. Eisenberg never worked on the case. He never did any memos. There's nothing in the file that suggests he had any work product. He never criticized her billing until this matter came up. And so there's a good deal of information in here for the court to have, or for the referee to have concluded that this affidavit included many misstatements. Then to compound matters, Mr. Eisenberg later in a letter to the OLR includes that affidavit. He supplements it to some extent. And while he does state, and I made a misstatement in my brief suggesting that he didn't state, that he did state that that affidavit information was compiled by his associates, he did not state that the information he was presenting was on information and belief. So basically, he told his employees to go out, gather information, he put it together in an affidavit, presented it to the court as to what he claimed was done in this case. Not once did they go back to Ms. Murphy and say, well, what did you do? Did you not bill for? Not once was there ever produced a shred of paper or work product by Mr. Eisenberg. So clear and convincing evidence, we believe, on that particular charge. In addition, as long as we're on the Swieziak matter, we have a situation where the client legitimately exercised her right of choice and chose to stay with Ms. Murphy after she left the Eisenberg office. She left in June 11th of 99, and at that point in time, Ms. Murphy asked Mr. Eisenberg for the file and asked for an accounting of the fees and so forth. Well, there were, by my count, 6 letters over the course of June, a couple more letters in July, and then by July 14, after about a month and a half of requests, Mr. Eisenberg writes back to Ms. Murphy suggesting that he's holding the file because he's investigating fraud. And then we launch into this, putting together through his staff this affidavit to justify what he thinks to be additional fees that are owing to his office. Not until there were motions to the court, and ultimately about a month and a half after the file was asked for, was it surrendered. We feel that, in that case, all the counts are proven by the requisite degree of proof. Now, on the Pro Hoc Vice application, if I can touch that subject,
I would ask you to, and if you could respond, what evidence is there in the record on the Pro Hoc Vice matter to sustain the conclusion that Mr. Eisenberg knowingly made a false statement of fact to a tribunal?
Justice Bradley, I would preface my comment by indicating that knowingly, as defined in the rules, can be inferred from the facts. There is a definition of knowingly in the rule book, saying that it can be inferred from the facts. What are those facts? Well, first of all, this is not a scrivener's error. This is an affidavit, members of the court. It's in the record. It's over in 2 pages, but it's essentially one paragraph affidavit. It's something that is, before you sign it, you are signing it under penalty of perjury. It says that. So this is not a document that's in a pile of letters that someone might carelessly not read and sign. This is an affidavit. This is an affidavit to be signed by an attorney to be presented to a foreign jurisdiction, California, saying, members of the court, this is who I am. This is my history. I want to come to your state to practice law. So first of all, it's a sworn affidavit. It seems to me it's somewhat more important, and there's more red flags that go up when you're signing an affidavit as opposed to something else. Likewise, it's a simple document. It's clear. It's not ambiguous. And thirdly, Mr. Eisenberg should be presumed to read what he signs. The referee has a choice here. Mr. Eisenberg says, well, I didn't do it. If I signed it, I didn't mean it. Well, a referee, fact finders, run into those contentions all the time and must make assessments based upon those facts. And I don't think his assessment, after looking at all of the facts, is clearly erroneous. That's his job.
Even in a 3-minute differential? Is there a 3-minute differential?
It's a short differential. I'm not sure if it's 2, 3, or 4, but there is a short turnover time. And indeed, the document was not prepared by him, but was prepared by another lawyer. But our response to that is, so what? It's still an affidavit. It's still something that the referee thought that, in the words of the referee, his defense rings hollow, is absolutely unbelievable. Now, in all due deference to this court,
Why would Mr. Eisenberg have signed, knowingly signed, a false affidavit?
Well, to gain admission to practice law in another state, to do his job, to work there, to be admitted to represent his client, to perform his advocacy on behalf of his client in another jurisdiction.
So if he had been disciplined in the past, he could not have been admitted there?
I don't know that to be the case. As I stand here, I don't know. That was never really determined. I think there was some suggestion that perhaps that criteria as to whether you had been disciplined earlier may not have been a barrier to practice. Our position is that it's an affidavit. It was signed. The referee did not believe his story, and the facts and circumstances are basically his word against the fact that there is his signature, there is the document, this is what it says, and well, his assessment of credibility.
It would seem to me that if he could not have gained pro hac vice admission if he had a prior discipline, that would provide a clear motive, I suppose, to submit knowingly a false affidavit. But if, in fact, that wouldn't have disqualified him, why would someone knowingly take the risk of submitting a false affidavit if it didn't mean it?
This record doesn't indicate that Mr. Eisenberg knew or didn't know at the time he was signing that document whether that discipline-free status was necessary to get into practice in California. I don't believe that's clearly set forth in this record. That after the fact, there was some presentation of information out of California that suggested that perhaps that wasn't a criteria to gain admittance. But whatever the situation, at the time the affidavit was presented, he signed it.
So it's your position that whether or not California would have denied him pro hac vice privileges because he didn't know that, he must have then been misrepresenting?
It's misrepresentation. It's a false.
But couldn't you look at it equally? What makes it more probable than not that it was a misrepresentation rather than a mistake?
Well, I went through what I consider to be the factors or the things that the court looked at. The court heard Mr. Eisenberg, heard his explanation, had the ability to look at him, hear what he had to say that we don't have at this point, saw the document, heard the testimony as to how it was prepared, understood the purpose of his representation, considered it to be a simple document, and simply said this doesn't make sense that he claims that he didn't inadvertently sign this document. I really have nothing further to add on that. I don't know how much further I can say on that.
Thank you.
Now, the Department of Transportation hearing, this is a process of members of the court where Mr. Eisenberg simply walks into a Department of Transportation hearing and tries to hijack the proceeding, simply tries to take it over. Be no different than if he walked into this courtroom and stood up there and asked you all to leave and indicated, I'm going to run this hearing.
Well, it would be, counsel, if he didn't know. Opposing counsel indicated that he didn't appreciate the fact that Ms. Shaw was treated as a judge.
Well,
that's what they've said.
Justice Wilcox, he had appeared in front of the department on many such occasions in these similar types of hearing, and in fact had appeared in front of Ms. Shaw. Ms. Shaw is the hearing officer. She runs the hearing. She listens to the testimony. She rules on evidence. She writes a decision. This is an argument that was made at the referee level that I think has been abandoned here at this court's level, but we heard it before. Also, it was argued at that time, seriously argued by Mr. Eisenberg, that Ms. Shaw was the one that disrupted the hearing, and Ms. Shaw somehow agitated him, causing him to do what he did. Nonsense. Nothing in this record that suggests that. And the referee found Mr. Eisenberg, when he's dictating what the rules are to be, telling the hearing officer, be quiet, found him to be abusive, disrespectful, rude, bellicose, threatening, all of those terms. And members of the court, and I believe it was Justice Crooks who mentioned that you had read the tape or saw the transcript of what happened at that hearing, or Justice Wilcox. The fact of the matter is there is an audio tape of that hearing. It's chilling if you listen to it. You don't really get the feel of it by reading it, but listen to that tape if you haven't already. and listen to the tone of the voice and the dictatorial manner by which Mr. Eisenberg is telling a quasi-judicial officer as to how to run the how to run her hearing. There's no excuse for this. This is not hardball lawyering. This is lowball. This is below-the-belt lawyering. There's absolutely no excuse for this. And offensive personality, listen to that tape. Read the transcript. Likewise, in the Corvallis situation, you know, offensive personality, the constitutionality of that term has been upheld by this court on prior occasions, and it is very hard to define. I guess it's somewhat akin to pornography, as earlier described. It's not easy to define, but certainly when one sees it, one knows what it is. Offensive personality, members of the court, in our view, is difficult to define. But trust me, when you hear it, and when you hear it on the Alan Eisenberg tapes in this case, if that's not offensive personality, I don't know what is. Now, the PPORA matter is a situation where there is an elderly, vulnerable client who obtains the services of Mr. Eisenberg to help with some code violations and some of her property in the inner city. Mr. Eisenberg is an attorney, but out of the same law office, under the same roof, he runs a real estate business. He holds the necessary licenses in the state to run that business. During the course of this representation, Mr. Eisenberg is suggesting that the client sell her property and, in fact, indicates to her that he would try to find a buyer, ultimately sends a letter to that effect, ultimately brings the client into his salesperson, a real estate salesperson in his office, Mr. Melendrez. The two of them meet. She signs a listing agreement for property. The Melendrez, the sales associate, and Eisenberg, everybody, the referee, concluded this is a binding contract for the sale of property. It's fair to infer, members of the court, that Mr. Eisenberg knew about this business transaction and this relationship. But actual knowledge is not required under 20:1.8 sub A, which strictly prohibits attorneys from getting involved in business transactions with clients unless two things are done, unless there's a written waiver of the client with permission granted, and unless the attorney advises that client to see another attorney for independent counsel. That was not done here. This is a clear violation of that rule. The Corvallis tape, once again, is vintage Eisenberg in terms of what was said and what was done. And it does demonstrate, Justice Crooks, a very serious pattern of conduct. If one listens to the Department of Transportation tape and the Corvallis tape, one right after the other, it's amazing the similarity. Here is an attorney licensed in Wisconsin who's being abusive to people in positions of authority or perceived to be in positions of authority for his own purposes or for what purposes, I don't know. And I don't really care. The fact of the matter is the conduct is, as described by the referee, inexcusable. The referee thought in terms of this and concluded in terms of these conversations and his explanations. He indicated that the respondent here threatened, lied, demanded, swore, insulted, and then hung up. Those are the referee's conclusions and findings. In the context of what happened, there was absolutely no purpose for this call. First of all, he wasn't even talking to Officer Kiefer. He was talking to a dispatcher. Secondly, the pretext under which he now claims he was excited and he was uttering the words he did doesn't make any sense. A police officer left a card asking Eisenberg's client to please call. So why in the dead of night, from a hotel room or a hotel lobby or a public phone in a hotel lobby, why in the dead of night would Mr. Eisenberg be calling a dispatcher identified as Peggy, indicating that he wants to get through to that thug, Officer Kiefer, who left the card. He wants to have his badge and other references that are part of the transcript and a part of the tape. What's the purpose of this? There's mocking laughter heard in the background. Mr. Eisenberg would now have you to believe that he did this because he's championing the rights of his client. In fact, he was pulling some kind of prank or having a good time. The referee didn't believe his explanation for 1 minute. There was absolutely no purpose for this call other than to bother another in violation of 20:4.4. The pretext for the call, that this was a life or death emergency to a dispatch service, was dishonest. It wasn't a life or death emergency. It wasn't anything that could even, by anyone's guesswork, could conclude under any scenario that this was a life or death emergency. And in all due respect to Mr. Cale, this is not hyperbole. This is not salty language. Come on. This is inexcusable, offensive language that has got no purpose other than to harass and belittle other people.
Let me tell you of a problem I have with regard to offensive personality, and respond to me, if you will. I think that what I see here is certainly beyond the pale. In one regard. And yet I have concerns about offensive personality charges, because it's my belief I have seen offensive conduct and exceedingly offensive personality, but boy, are they polite.
Are they polite?
Polite.
They are polite.
They are polite. They can say please and thank you, but be exceedingly offensive in their personality and their conduct. So I just have a hard time. I have a hard time with that. So explain to me how I should think that offensive personality applies to impolite language and should be applied to that only.
Well, I can understand that situation where what may be considered intemperate, offensive to one person may not to another, or the tone by which it's said, or the context in which it is said. You may be left with a fairly elusive standard to deal with. I appreciate that. That was what the court considered in the Heilprin case, and I think it has to be looked on a case-by-case basis. I can't explain what may be offensive to one person and what may not be offensive. All I can say is, in the Allen Eisenberg case, what we have here is offensive by even the most narrow definition of that term. When you come into a Department of Transportation hearing and tell the hearing officer to be quiet, I'm going to run things my way, or when you're calling attempting to call police officers thugs and threatening to have their badge and threatening people on the phone, that's offensive. I'm sorry, I can sympathize with your concern, because I understand how this can be a problem in terms of what's offensive in the context and everything else. I appreciate that probably doesn't answer your question.
Mr.
Go ahead, Justice Brass.
Could I ask, on the offensive personality issue, are there times when the rule doesn't apply anymore, that you're in a private capacity? I mean, when we're talking about our Oregon situation, he's not in court at that point. Just hypothetically.
Well,
at the Packer game with the Bears. I mean, can you be offensive there?
If you're a Packer fan, you can't be offensive.
Obviously not. I mean, when is the rule always on when you're an attorney?
Well, I think it's inferred in these rules, just like any other rule, that it relates to your conduct in a capacity as an attorney. No one's suggesting attorneys can't be offensive outside of the bounds of being an attorney. And I think we can all admit to being offensive in many respects. But I think these rules apply in the context of legal advocacy, which is what we have in the Department of Transportation case. And even though it's a call made in the dead of night to the Corvallis Police Department, Mr. Eisenberg identifies himself as an attorney. He's in the course of representing his client. He's trying to reach an investigating officer, so he's working as a lawyer. So the answer is, I think that the standard applies as to lawyerly functions and not otherwise. As far as sanction is concerned, if I can get to that in the remaining 7 or 8 minutes, indeed, we did recommend a 1-year suspension. The referee asked for a revocation. The violations here are serious. They're multiple. the defenses, in all due respect to Mr. Kao and his client, I think are dishonest, deceptive, and I think it's quite clear that the referee is true when he says that Mr. Eisenberg has no appreciation for the seriousness of his conduct. Now, his comportment during the hearing was important to the referee. We didn't know how he would behave at the hearing when we made our recommendation. We didn't know how the referee would interpret the evidence. We, frankly, did little discovery in this case and really didn't have a feeling as to how Mr. Eisenberg would react, what some of his defenses would be, some of which have been abandoned at this level, but which were presented to the referee. So there is support in the record for the recommendation of the referee, I believe. That's not to say that a suspension wouldn't be appropriate also.
What's the difference between a suspension and a revocation?
The difference is suspension entitles one, depending on the length of the suspension, to return to practice earlier, and the revocation, the likelihood of that is far more limited.
You have to wait for, 5 years on a revocation?
Yes, I believe so. 5 years, yeah.
So it's a 5-year suspension, in effect.
5-year suspension would be then automatic. Well, you'd have to reapply to get admitted.
Mr. Crowan, I almost have a sense that there is a sixth count. I almost have a sense that there is a sixth count in
sixth
this case.
Count.
That is offensive personality and lack of credibility at the referee's hearing.
Well, it certainly seems like the referee's reaction to the credibility issues and the posturing and the defenses offered by Mr. Eisenberg obviously must have had some role in his recommendation. I can't deny that, but that's not to say that there aren't facts in the record to support that, and that his recommendation is, in our view, not clearly erroneous. The concern is here that Mr. Eisenberg still seems to blame others, whether it's Ms. Murphy or whether it's the Corvallis police or whoever, and doesn't seem to take a lot of responsibility. And our concern is about the two prior suspensions in 70 and 98. In 77, Mr. Eisenberg was admonished by this court to show more respect towards courts. 1998 was involved in some business arrangements with clients. And this conduct here, I think, goes well beyond the bounds of zealous advocacy. Now, we did recommend a 1-year suspension.
I was looking at my notes. There were two times, other than the public reprimand, one was in the 70s, the other was 1988. I think you misspoke. There was nothing in 98, was there?
88.
All right.
Did I say 98?
I thought you did, yes.
Two prior suspensions, 1970 and 1988. One public reprimand in 96, I believe.
Right.
And the suspensions were for what duration and how long after they expired was there before he was readmitted?
I don't know. I'd have to look at those decisions. I don't have that in mind at this moment. I can certainly, while I'm seated, look that up and respond to it.
And the reason I ask is because it may make a difference what period of time elapsed before there was a relapse, if you will.
There is a considerable...
I just don't know the chronology.
There is a considerable gap between now and those prior events, and I understand Mr. Kao's position on that, but the other side of that could be that we can say, over time, Mr. Eisenberg simply still hasn't learned the lesson of what those prior decisions stood for. I think the discipline here, although we recommended a 1-year suspension, we acknowledge that was our position. The referee came up with the notion of a revocation. I think it's up to this court and its discretion and determination to look at all of the facts and determine what's appropriate. I think under some views of the evidence, a 1-year suspension or greater would be appropriate up to a revocation, and that is a decision for the court. I think that the egregious nature of the conduct and the defenses offered and the explanations are such that probably caused the referee to ratchet up our recommendation a bit.
Well, what's wrong with the public reprimand that's recommended by opposing counsel?
I don't think that. Mr. Akeo suggests that that's to be provided in light of the fact that 2 or 3 of these counts weren't proven. First of all, I think there's clear, satisfactory, and convincing evidence on all the counts, and they're not the findings are not clearly erroneous by this referee. And if you add them together, a public reprimand simply doesn't do the job here, doesn't send the message, is not adequate, not an adequate sanction by any means. And that's based upon our belief that these counts have all been proven, solidly proven. I have more time, but I have nothing left to say unless there are questions.
Are there any questions? Hearing none,
thank you,
Mr. Crone. Mr. Eisenberg, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
First of all, the recommendation of a one-year suspension came only after the hearing before the referee. Counsel took a position that many thousands of hours of pro bono work and community service work mean nothing as far as this type of hearing is concerned, because they don't need a license to do those things. But if you go back over my 40-year love affair with the practice of law, the things that I have done have almost always only been because I had a law license, because I was a recognized attorney. The judicial forums that I conducted over the course of a lifetime and appeared with judges, that was only because I had a law license, and I brought about those things because of my law license. The community service that I've done, the boards that I've sat on, the thousands of hours of pro bono litigation that I've done for people, I was only able to do those things because I have a law license. Counsel has a very narrow view of what a law license means to the individual and the rest of the people in this state. Yes, people may think badly of a lawyer and of lawyers because somebody like myself has gone overboard. I make mistakes, and when I make them, they're a pip. And what more can I do than apologize? These are mistakes. These are lessons that are learned. They're hard lessons to learn. They've been extremely expensive. Starting with Swieziak, this has been going on. This whole business has been going on for 5 years. How many times can I apologize? I apologize again. I'm sorry for the mistakes that I've made. I say it sincerely and from the heart. He wants this to be, for my law practice and maybe for me, my long green mile. What he asks for now, as opposed to the one-year suspension after the hearing, would be the death of my law practice. It would certainly be the death of my law practice. I want to practice law. I want to help people. And perhaps there will be a day when Black's Law Dictionary will have my picture where it says offensive personalities. Maybe that's what it means to answer all of your questions. Maybe it means me, a guy who goes overboard, but maybe for the right reasons. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Eisenberg, and thank you, Mr. Crone and Mr. Kao, for your argument in 02-03860D, OLR versus Eisenberg. That in. He didn't, but go to the back of the podium, Mr. Eisenberg. And don't make a pip.
I was shocked by something that took place, which seems to be a new policy of the court. I don't know, maybe this has been going on for a long time. But I started getting phone calls from reporters. And I was surprised to learn that in announcing this event today, the court sent out press releases. And I started getting the press release, which we have here today, appears to have been drafted by a layperson. It isn't an effort at a balanced rendition of the charge. It isn't even completely accurate, but that's okay. It was done by a layperson. But I don't understand this new policy of the court. I mean, my time was a long time ago, but the idea that, I mean, when I go to circuit court hearings, the circuit courts don't send out press releases talking about how guilty my client is. And I realize that this isn't a jury and a jury pool, but it's been a daily trauma getting these phone calls because of this court's press release. One reporter asked me if I was going to be going to prison. And of course, lay people don't distinguish between civil lawyer charges and criminal charges. But that's the way it was framed. And I would hope and pray, my offensive personality aside, that you would abandon the practice of doing this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Eisenberg. That concludes our hearing in the Eisenberg matter and concludes our hearings for today. The court is adjourned until its February sessions on oral argument. We will be in administrative conference tomorrow at 9:00.